We need to discuss Timothée Chalamet at the Nymphomaniac premiere wearing galaxy leggings.
Yeah, it's actually the top issue for the nation.
Have you seen Nymphomaniac, the trilogy?
I haven't.
Oh my god. Brutal. It's brutal. Yeah. I can't remember if it's, like, good, to be honest. I watched it in high school in, like, my little edgelord phase. So I was kind of like, I need to watch edgy movies. And it's deeply unenjoyable is the thing. I don't think it's bad. It's just, like, fucking unpleasant.
I've read plot descriptions and I was like, you know, I'm not jumping at the bit to watch this.
It's an extremely, like, pessimistic group of movies, I'll say that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I love that Timothée Chalamet, how old do you think he was in those pictures?
Well, he's, like, what, a year older than me, I think. So if that was probably 2013 or 2014, he would have been, like, 18 or 19 or 17. 17, 18 or 19. I'm not doing the math. Don't ask me to do math.
That is way too late in fashion for him to be wearing galaxy print pants.
They're not pants. That's the funniest part. They're like leggings. They're fully leggings. I think he was trolling us.
I don't think so. So, okay, you give Timothée Chalamet way too much credit. He will forever be that guy inside. And that's why when he like wears his little hypebeast outfits, I'm like, yeah. And you started in galaxy print leggings. I love and respect him, but that
is ridiculous. No, Hannah, come on. Wearing hypebeast clothing and wearing galaxy print leggings are two very different things. Like, as a teenage boy, wearing galaxy print leggings is an insane choice. Yeah, in 2013-14, like, what's going on there? It doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. When you watch those old videos of him performing in school, I'm like, yeah, that is that annoying kid at the arts high school that would be in galaxy.
He's giving the one straight kid in theater class. Yeah, like, and we would have all been in love with him in high school. Absolutely. He looks so happy to be there in all those photos. He's giving two thumbs up to the camera.
He loves it. Do you think they let him in?
Yeah, probably. No, they got to the door and they were like, I mean, it is R-rated, I'm pretty sure. Or like, it was like NC-17, I think.
Who brought him? Like, how did he get on that red carpet?
Interstellar brought him.
Was he in Interstellar already?
Wasn't that movie like 2012?
No, because in 2012, Nolan put out The Dark Knight Rises, actually.
I think Interstellar is from 2012.
Okay.
Nymphomaniac, we've discovered, came out in 2013, as I thought, but then Interstellar actually came out in 2014, as Hannah thought. But we don't know which of the Nymphomaniac trilogy he was at. Anyways, sleuthing work, very important stuff.
Yes, somebody call Club Chalamet.
Yeah, let her know. Yesterday, as is our custom, we were together and we went to this cafe.
As is our custom, we were together?
We were just always together. Yeah, our custom.
That is true.
In a terrible way. It's like how I hate on twins for always being together, except you and I are always together.
I was going to joke about how at least we don't wear matching outfits, but sometimes we accidentally
do. We're starting to look like each other too, like by accident. We keep doing things to our appearance that slowly merge us together.
It's like we're both single white femaling the other.
Yeah. Anyways, so we went to this cafe and I was getting a breakfast sandwich and Hannah was just coming for the vibes and she was like, can you get me that lollipop? There's like a lollipop on the counter and I was like, sure, you're not beating the I'm a small child allegations. But so then I had to be like to the barista, hey, can I have this breakfast sandwich and also this lollipop for my friend?
Well, because the lollipops are like 40 cents. They don't take cash at that cafe. I'm not gonna whip out my debit card for a 40 cent lollipop.
I mean, the greater question is just like, why are you having a lollipop?
Because sometimes you just, it's nice,
it's jouissance.
Live a little.
Let's get started.
Okay, I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is a loose, no pun intended, history of sex on the internet, the symbiosis of humanity's two most basic instincts, innovation and getting off. If you like our show and want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps a lot. Today we are going to be talking about a law that basically is considered the foundation of the internet as we know it today, which is Section 230 of the Communications Act. And we're going to be talking about the bill that was passed to amend it, called SESTA-FOSTA. In 2018, a bill was passed to basically amend Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act.
Which we talked about in our Is Anyone Up episode.
Yes, which will be kind of a recurring character for a few episodes this season.
She's like Janice in Friends.
Well, yes.
She keeps coming back and you're like, oh.
Why? Yeah. FOSTA-SESTA basically amended a very important piece of legislation in order to limit the abilities to promote sex work or even talk about it on the internet, all under the guise of ending human and child trafficking. So we're going to be getting into that, but first we have to go back in time, as usual, and we're going to start analog style with the newspapers.
Oh my god.
So how familiar are you with alt weeklies? You know what an alt weekly is.
Yeah, yeah. I have a general understanding. Like the Village Voice is an alt weekly. It's like a weekly newspaper that comes out. I know we have one in Toronto called Now Magazine. That's kind of the extent of what I know. Like it's like alternative press, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe our less extensive knowledge on it is just because the alt weekly as we know it has sort of died for some reasons that come up in this story. But basically, yeah, they popped up in the 20th century, usually as sort of like a left-wing, like anti-establishment alternative to like local papers. They're usually like pretty politically involved and willing to push boundaries, challenge politicians in ways that like an establishment media company might not. And then, yeah, one of the original and like most famous ones is the New York-based Village Voice, which we will be talking about later.
It's been a great help this season research-wise. Like the Village Voice puts out some pretty awesome stuff.
Yeah, they published the Julian Dibble essay that I used in my episode on cybersex, and it was one of the most fascinating things I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be starting off with a different alt weekly, though, which is the Phoenix New Times. So in 1970, like a group of Arizona State University students started an alt weekly called the Phoenix New Times, basically to protest their school's refusal to lower the flag in honor of anti-war demonstrators killed in the Kent State Massacre. So from there, it grows and it changes its name to simply the New Times. And with their success over the years, two of its founders, Michael Lacey and Jim Larkin, would go on to buy like a number of local alt-weeklies in other cities and sort of create like a monopoly under the umbrella company of the New Times. And these guys are interesting figures. They're going to play a central role in the story. Like a lot of people working in kind of like alternative journalism, they consider themselves free speech warriors. They're not afraid to like push boundaries and like challenge the man. They love to talk about how often they get sued and win. Like their longtime lawyer described their approach to business as, fuck you, we don't have friends, we have lawyers.
I'm not here to make friends.
Yeah, well, precisely. And they think of themselves, in contrast to other like alt-weekly publishers, as these anti-elitist kind of like real guys. Like,
what are the other alt-weekly publishers?
Well, so there's this story that I read from a guy who used to edit at San Francisco Weekly in the 90s, and he tells this story about how they were at like a conference basically for alt weeklies, and they were joking about their reader base, and he joked about how his reader base were like existentialist, like college students, anti-establishment, smoking, or people in bands that were too cool to know the names of, and
like
stuff.
The bourgeois socialists
basically camp. And I can't remember if it was Lacey or Larkin, but one of them was there, and it pissed them off so much that they bought that newspaper the next year. And over a decade later, in some testimony, brought up this guy's comment and were like, we hate this kind of like attitude towards.
They were like, see, Your Honor, he's annoying.
Yeah, basically. So I guess in that way, they seem more like bro-y. They're like too mixed from the sticks, as they've been described. And their papers run in like less cosmopolitan and like more conservative cities compared to something like New York or LA. Are you getting a sense of their vibes at all?
Yeah, they sound kind of annoying, but, yeah. But I support their work.
Do they not remind you of anarchist bros that we might know, like the types of guys that want to just get into fights for the sake of it.
Totally. It's like we've discussed before, but the guys we know who go to protests because they want to get a black eye.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, precisely. That kind of thing.
And you're like, okay, you're there, so that counts. But the reason you're there, a little dubious.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes their intentions feel dubious, but in what sometimes feels like a sort of dick measuring situation, they do good work. They were arrested by Joe Arpaio, who was this Arizona sheriff who's notorious for being extremely racist and like anti-immigration and basically had these like, terrible prison camps. They were arrested by him and then they sued him for false arrest or something and they won. And then they used the money to like put towards services to help like immigrants, basically.
Like the end justifies the means.
In a lot of cases, yes. Even if they're like dicks. We mentioned earlier our local alt weekly is Now Magazine. Have you ever picked up a coffee?
Back in the day, many years ago, yes.
Can you tell me what you might find if you flip to the back?
The back is kind of covered in ads and a lot of them are for escorts.
Yeah, there's like if you were a kid and you had a Now Magazine, you might go and peek at the back and you'd be seeing pictures of like ladies in lingerie or whatever.
Sexy ladies.
Yeah, basically. And this is like very common for basically any alt weekly. For decades, the alt weekly industry and the sex industry had relied on the other for business. And this includes like sex workers, strip clubs, phone sex companies, etc. The New Times, for example, integrated their like adult classified section in 1989. What do you think the benefits of this like business relationship might be?
The escorts obviously having a place to showcase their business.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not just the business of people buying the magazines because a lot of the time they're free or they're...
Oh, right, yeah.
Or they're for donation. Like they're not always free. But it's also that basically like newspapers in general rely on people buying classifieds for a lot of revenue. Mm. And so... what alt weeklies could do that, like, you know, an establishment newspaper couldn't is sell adult classified ads. And that ended up being a very lucrative and, like, important part of their...
Right, their ad spots. Yes, 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 yes. I kind of forgot about how the financial structure of newspapers worked. But yeah, most newspapers are funded by this idea of companies buying ads within them. And that's how they make their money.
And it also, like, was beneficial for sex workers because, you know... sex work, especially like street sex work, can be very dangerous. And this like allowed them to kind of have clients come to them rather than like maybe going out on the street. So it was good for both parties. However, in like the 90s and the early 2000s, a number of factors led to the decline in adult ads across the country. So like changes in local legislation, shifting values around the sex industry, and other advertisers and sponsors not wanting to be like
be associated
with that reputation, basically.
And this is going to become very prevalent for the rest of the season.
Well, yes. So in response, sex workers went online, and like as we've established in past episodes, like the sex industry has really helped build the internet, and this includes like some particularly entrepreneurial sex workers who learn to code their own websites and set up electronic payment services before other businesses even thought to.
Sex workers who code.
Well, yes. It's
women in STEM.
Women in STEM, exactly. And also, like, in general, sex workers were able to utilize the tools of the internet to make their jobs safer. So they could communicate with one another via message boards and share stories about clients. They'd have, like, bad date lists, which is where... you'd list guys that sucked, pre-screen potential customers, and like post online classified ads on websites. And they were able to advertise their services online thanks to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act.
And what is that?
Well, let me tell you. So Section 230 is an extremely important part of internet history, as I said at the top. Basically, like in the mid-90s, when the internet is this new lawless land, there's a lot of questions about the liability of websites that allow third-party posting. So, like, a couple people try to sue websites for allowing others to post things that they find defamatory or offensive. And lawmakers realize that this could hinder the development of the emerging internet economy.
Yeah, so when you think about Is Anyone Up, the reason that Hunter Moore was able to get away with it for so long was precisely because of this section creating a loophole for him, in that because he wasn't posting and third-party people were posting the nudes on his website, he could get away with it because he wasn't held liable.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And it's like when they were back in the day coming up with like obscenity laws, for example, and people who ran bookstores that sold materials that were considered obscene, I think there was a time where they could maybe have been liable for selling that material, but I think the laws changed so that it was understood that they weren't the ones saying it, they were simply hosting it.
Yeah, they're like, I did not do this.
Yes, I did not do that. And so they put in this amendment to the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which protects Internet Computer Services, or ICSs, from liability for things published on their websites, like we said. And companies, you know, are still encouraged to impose their own forms of moderation, and most do. But this takes the blame off of them in many cases where, you know, something falls through the cracks, basically. So for online classifieds like Craigslist, which got very popular in the early 2000s.
How I found every apartment I have.
Hell yeah. This was sort of like a loophole that allowed them to sell ads soliciting sex, basically, because they were simply the messenger. You mentioned, you know, it being used in like Is Anyone Up? But can you think of like any other important uses for Section 230 or where it might come in handy?
I mean, I keep coming back to Facebook. I mean, this isn't useful, actually. This has been horrible. Facebook not being held liable for, like, neo-Nazi content getting spread on there. So I guess that's not a good use of the Decency Act.
But this kind of exemplifies why it's such a divisive law, because the internet as we know it, especially when based on social media, would not exist without Section 230, because why would you invest in starting a website that allows other people to publish their thoughts if you would be held responsible for it?
Mm-hmm. It creates a bit more of like a liberated open ground for web development, I guess.
And for free speech.
Which...
But that's always the tricky thing with free speech, right?
Free speech is annoying.
Like, on both sides of the aisle, for often different reasons, like politicians have been like, we need to make big changes to Section 230. But it is kind of like undeniably like very important to the internet we have today, which isn't necessarily a great internet, but is what we know.
It is what we know.
But on the other hand, if we're talking like politically, it's like, well, then I think it would be harder for us to use it in like positive ways of expressing ourselves. It's a complicated law. It's complicated.
I just think it's interesting because with online sex work, and we'll see this in other episodes, like the internet is, because of its lawlessness and because it's the Wild West, it creates this like liberatory space for marginalized voices to be heard in a way that they would never be heard or they'd be silenced otherwise. And so I think this definitely allows for that to happen.
Definitely, definitely. But then, of course, it allows for all sorts of voices, like you're saying, and some voices.
I'm like, some of you should hush.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as useful as Craigslist is for the sex industry, it creates a very real threat to the newspaper industry. So classified ad sales are an integral source of revenue for outlets, like we said. And even outside of adult classifieds, like regular newspapers are really hurt by Craigslist because you can't put like a classified in for like a job posting or like a garage sale or whatever, because it would get so much more attention on Craigslist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been considered sort of like the newspaper killer, even from early on in its existence. So the dudes of the New Times decide that if they can't beat Craigslist, they should join them. And in 2004, ad salesman Carl Ferrer comes up with the idea of creating a competing site, Backpage. And like Craigslist, Backpage will have classified ads for basically like everything under the sun, including erotic services, which they'll charge like an extra $2 to post.
And is that what differentiates them from Craigslist?
No, they're basically the same thing. They're literally like, well, let's get a slice of this pie.
Yeah, get in there while we can.
Early-ish days, yeah.
The adult classified gold rush.
Well, exactly, yeah. And of course, they're like still under their shadow, but whatever. In their shadow.
Whatever.
Whatever.
Sometimes you have to live in the shadow.
So the following year, in 2005, even though the newspaper industry is in trouble, the New Times decides to seize on the opportunity to buy the Village Voice, which is the Alt Weekly, like you said, and they merge companies and become Village Voice Media. People at the Village Voice are pissed about this. People in the Alt Weekly industry hate these guys. But out of their two new business ventures, Backpage proves to be like the real breadwinner, as I'm sure you can imagine. Sex sells.
Sex sells.
So in 2010, Craigslist takes down its erotic services section after scrutiny from institutions like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or NCMEC, and the National Association of Attorneys General, who were accusing it of facilitating child exploitation and human trafficking on the site. Like, through these ads, basically.
Great.
So Craigslist, they try to work with them a bit, but they go, okay, fine, we're taking this off our site entirely. And with them out of the way, Backpage inherits not only its consumer base, but like all of the problems that come with it, all of the heat that was on Craigslist.
No offense, but Craigslist are kind of pussies.
You heard it here first, folks.
Have a backbone. Have a spine. Craig.
His name is Craig.
Grow some balls, Craig.
And so, like, having this heat is a challenge that Lacey and Larkin are, like, happy to take on because they basically have the essence of men who actively try to get into bar fights, like we said. And it also makes them very rich because Backpage is very lucrative. And unlike Craig Newmark of Craigslist, who kind of seems like a nice guy from interviews I read with him, they are not really concerned about their reputation or like appeasing anyone as long as they have the law in their corner, which they do with Section 230.
Sorry, Craig.
Thank God we have Section 230 or else we would get sued by Craig or something.
No.
For defamation.
Definitely not.
For defamation of his character. Yes. A lawsuit is filed against Backpage from a 14-year-old girl claiming she was sex trafficked with the assistance of ads posted on their site. And it gets dismissed because of Section 230, because legally they were not considered liable. But I'm curious, do you think that that's totally fair? On a philosophical level, do you think that there should be some culpability?
I do think that the companies should at least be trying to make sure this doesn't happen in some capacity. Like, that just can't be happening on your site, like, under your purview, you know? Even if you're not legally liable, it's like, are you morally liable? Like, I think that's the question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that's something that I come back to when I think about these guys and I think about the stuff that they're doing. Like, it's almost like they have accidentally done decent things, but like under the guise of just being like, we are basically like libertarian free speech warriors or whatever, and don't actually care about like the negative consequences of their actions.
I don't actually know what this metaphor means, but I'm assuming this is what it means, but it feels like opening Pandora's box a little bit, or like it feels like deregulation, or just feels like opening something and letting it run free. And often it runs free for a while and it's doing good things, and then it kind of turns into a monster. Being like, okay, I created this thing and now I'm going to step back and be like, sorry. It feels like Sam Altman with ChatGPT, right? Like, oh, I created this technology for a free democratic world and now my technology is going to be used to destroy thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs, but that's not my fucking problem, even though I'm the one who made it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like there's powerful tools, and when they're not in the hands of somebody that could be using them ethically, they get out of hand entirely.
Oh, it's giving Oppenheimer. How did that take me so long?
It's giving Oppenheimer. Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree. A lot of people say yes, and it's cases like this where Backpage is continuously shielded by 230 that make them like a huge target for anti-trafficking groups and advocates. And then they're subpoenaed in 2015, and they're accused of manipulating the allowances of Section 230 by creating moderation practices that like basically taught posters to sanitize their content so that it could fly under the radar of like their guidelines.
Well, that's the thing. It's not like they have this website and it just exists freely and does whatever it wants. It's like they're tending to it like a garden. You're making changes to the site, like, and to the functions of the site, to the affordances of the site that make these things possible. Like, it's the same with the Facebook algorithm and saying, yes, oh, well, it's not our fault. And it's like, well, you created this algorithm that's hyper specific, so it's going to create the foundations for what is to come.
Oh, yeah. And in this case, based off of everything that was found in the subpoena, it's not just that they were like being negligent, it's like they were sort of helping people in a sense, because so they basically they had an automated filter that would remove flagged words like rape, Lolita, or little girl before actual human moderators could see it. And so there was like nothing for them to report to law enforcement if they saw it. So like shit like that was going under the radar.
So then how would those have been advertised, like with coded language?
Coded language, yes. And then they would inform posters whose ads they like banned or edited, like specifically why they were banning it, which basically taught them to change the language that they were using.
Because I guess sex is like their bread and butter. So
yeah,
they're kind of like, okay, well, we can't let this fall by the wayside. We have to protect it almost.
Yeah. And also if you're a company that is routinely reporting unsavory shit under your already kind of like legally dubious like adult classified section, you're basically bringing more attention to yourself like from law enforcement by reporting it. So I think they were rather like
totally yeah. I mean, I think it's in a similar way YouTube, and we're gonna find out why YouTube is like this now, but YouTube, when I'm posting a video, has a function where you, the poster who has everything to lose, has to report what in your video violates community guidelines and to what extent, and then you submit it for review and then they come back and review it. And it's like, okay, well, why the fuck
would you snitch
would
on yourself?
I snitch on myself? I'm no snitch. And so I'll go none of the above, submit rating, even though my video has the word, I don't know, sex in it, but it's like that apparently violates community guidelines. I'm not gonna tell them that. I'm not gonna narc on myself. So it's kind of like, yeah, I understand it from a very far away point of view.
From a faraway point of view.
But not in this context.
Not in this context, because guess what? You are not hosting, like, discussing...
I'm not hosting child sex trafficking on my YouTube channel.
Basically, yes. There was also evidence that employees of Backpage had at least some knowledge that, like, underage girls were being posted on there as well. So I have a hard time considering them as being these kind of like just noble free speech warriors, wherein it's like, I think they realized where the money was.
I mean, again, in our endless critique of tech entrepreneurs, the rebellious free spirit can only go so far until it meets capitalism, and then it becomes a very insidious free spirit.
Yeah, exactly. And so this information that comes out, it really fuels the crusade against Backpage. And so we're going to talk a bit about the anti-sex trafficking movement and FOSTA SESTA. Sex trafficking is like one of the rare bipartisan issues. Like, it manages to make strange bedfellows out of feminists and Republican politicians alike. And it's also like a really popular celebrity cause. Seth Meyers and Amy Schumer and like Selena Gomez have all kind of taken it on.
Let's just say Selena Gomez has the most boring politics. She's like, love your friends, hate is bad. Her politics are so obnoxiously apolitical.
Oh yeah, it's very much like end online bullying.
Yeah, she's just like, be kind heart, but also I won't speak out against genocide.
But I was gonna ask, like, yeah, why do you think this is such a unifying cause?
Well, not to shamelessly plug myself, but plug I have away. A video But I have a video in my Taboo on Screen series that I'm doing with Nebula about Pretty Baby. And what I think we realized from the research in that video is just that the child is just this neutralizing force. The child is this conception that was kind of created in the Victorian era. Children before that were like laborers. People procreated basically to create more laborers for their like family households. But then in the Victorian era, bourgeois and like upper class people decided like, oh, childhood is something that needs to be protected. Children are vulnerable. They're still growing. They have like an innocence to them. So then, and this is very lovely that this happened. Children, you know, were taken out of the workforce. Childhood became something that needed to be protected and coveted, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think since that era and over the course of like the 20th century and the 21st century, the child has become this symbol of all the world's virtues. I've read a lot about it in research about humanitarian advertising as well, the way that the child's face has become the face of, like, Africa, for example, to kind of pull on the heartstrings of potential donors and stuff like that. Like, it, and in doing so, has kind of infantilized Africa. But it just in saying that the child is something everyone can get behind as an idea, because we've all been children once. It's something we can all relate to.
Except and, Benjamin Button.
Well, he can. He is a child. Eventually. At some point.
Yes. Sorry.
But yeah, it's just become a neutralizing force because it has become synonymous with innocence and synonymous with virtue.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. Like, everyone can get behind the children. And then also, as a cause has, like, historically been weaponized in arguments against, like, immigration and to, like, stigmatize marginalized communities in the name of innocent white women and children. And I think that certain sects of feminism get on board for that very easily. There's also sects of feminism that are, like, anti-sex industry and don't believe in consensual sex work. There's a really, really great episode on human trafficking from You're Wrong About. Just to plug it, because I re-listened to it preparing for this episode, and, like, I think if you really want something that debunks a lot of the myths of it and, like, the statistics, it's a really great companion listen.
I feel like it kind of changed my life a bit, that episode. Like, it has completely altered my worldview.
Yeah, it's a really, really smart, and I didn't want to go over too much of, like, what they say in the episode, but please listen to that.
I think we've talked about it before on this podcast.
Yeah, probably. But what's very dangerous about the cause against sex trafficking is that it, of course, conflates consensual sex work with forced sex work and puts, like, an already at-risk group in major harm's way. So a major example of this is FOSTA SESTA. So in 2017, two companion bills are born, which is the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, or FOSTA, and the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, SESTA. And the purpose of FOSTA SESTA is to...
I'm sorry, it sounds like a venereal disease.
I know. It's a really awful name. And also, why not just pick one?
Pick one. Pick they one mean name. The same thing, basically. Yeah,
they are, from my understanding, the same. You know what? For such an ugly bill, it deserves ugly name.
Nice.
But the purpose of FOSTA SESTA is to basically amend Section 230 so that it doesn't apply to websites which knowingly facilitate prostitution and child sex trafficking. So for reasons given earlier, it is a smash hit on both sides of the aisle, basically. Everyone's like, yes, the children. In the 2020 election, like, basically all of the, like, Democratic candidates were pro SESTA FOSTA.
FOSTA SESTA.
FOSTA SESTA. Oh my God. On its surface, just understanding it in those terms, like, how are you feeling about FOSTA SESTA? Like, how does it sound on sort of, like, a cursory glance?
On paper, you're like, well, yes, somebody think of the children, and, well, yes, obviously, child sex trafficking is bad. I think that's the thing, is that the other reason all these people can get behind these causes is because it's like, yeah, we all agree child sex trafficking is bad. Obviously. It's just an obvious thing. It's like a bad thing to do to someone, especially a child. So obviously you can easily get behind it if you see it on paper. You're like, well, yes.
Well, yeah.
Save the children.
It pulls at your heartstrings, and you're like, when there are, like, anecdotes that come out about it, you're like, that's fucked up. Like, that shouldn't be allowed to happen. But
it is fucked up.
But it's a bit more complicated than that. This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there is always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Coming on March 15th, exclusively to Mubi in North America and many other countries, is The Last Year of Darkness, a beautiful new documentary by Ben Mollenkhausen that offers a peek into China's alternative club scene. Following a cast of creative characters who congregate at the nightclub Funky Town, the film really highlights the important roles that underground spaces play in a city's culture. The Last Year of Darkness is an intimate portrait of a changing city told through the eyes of the inhabitants who risk being left behind. And in this way, it speaks to the experiences of city dwellers worldwide. You can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/rehash. That's MUBI.com/rehash for a whole month of great cinema for free. So FOSTA SESTA is, like, built to help these children, but there are a lot of people that it actually really hurts, obviously, the first of which are actual sex workers. What is taken for granted, basically, by those arguing in favor of FOSTA SESTA are the perspectives and, like, the lives of sex workers. Street-based sex work is incredibly dangerous, even compared to other forms of sex work. There aren't really ways to vet new clients. You're more likely to be working with pimps. And, like, soliciting in public spaces leads to more run-ins with law enforcement.
And you're going back to a private space one-on-one with one other person. There's so, so much risk.
Yeah.
So many sex workers have been murdered since the beginning of time, basically. It's like, yeah. I think one of the higher percentages, I don't know the exact statistic, of homicides is against sex workers.
I saw a statistic somewhere that I think said, I don't remember what time it was from, but it was basically like the death rate for street sex workers was 13 times the regular population, or like the murder rate.
Totally. In Canada, we have an especially egregious problem with Indigenous sex workers being murdered because the authorities will never try and find them.
Well, exactly. And a lot of the times, you know, sex work is something that people do when they're in situations where they need money and there's, you know, financial and economic insecurity. Like, a lot of people who do sex work are part of already marginalized groups. And people feel that they can get away with more violence towards sex workers because of their already marginalized identities, basically.
And I think this recent turn to label all these different forms of sex work as sex work does kind of shroud the very hard distinction between street sex work and the other forms of sex work. Like, street sex work is very different than OnlyFans, very different than camgirling, very different from stripping, very different from all these things. Like, it is the highest risk.
Yeah, it's definitely the riskiest form.
And the reasons for getting in it are often quite different as well.
Well, it's often like survival sex work. Mm-hmm. And especially like in these specific situations. And so having access to online resources doesn't completely take away all of these problems, but it does mitigate them. Sex workers have been saying, like, the internet keeps me at least somewhat safe. There's also just a sense of community that comes from it.
Totally.
What's more is that VostaSessa doesn't just impact classifieds. Basically, any website that allows people to post in a way that may seem like it's facilitating sex work could be liable, which led a lot to really harshen their guidelines. So, like, not only can sex workers not find work online, but it's also harder for them to communicate with each other and, like, talk about their work, share things about clients and everything.
I don't want to make this sound like it's, like, a psyop or something, but, like, a huge tactic of government oppression is to kind of divide groups and to make sure that they can't communicate with each other, is to silo them. And I feel like there's almost an element of that here, dividing these sex workers, making sure they can't gather, they can't talk, you know, in these spaces, destroying these forums is almost a way to do that.
Well, it kind of reminds me of, you know, the way that cities will now design themselves so that they're inhospitable for homeless people. But what they're doing isn't getting rid of the homeless population. They're not solving homelessness. They're just kind of like obscuring it and making it harder to see. And in a similar way, it feels like, one, I don't think that they need to solve the existence of sex work, but that is in a way their objective. They're actually just kind of making it harder for people to see it or know that it exists.
Sex work is one of the most ancient forms of work, and on top of being around forever, will never go away, ever.
No. I agree with you. Also, there's this really interesting statistic that gets used in like quite a few articles that I've read while researching this topic, and it's from the Journal of Human Resources. And the researchers basically look at the female homicide rate in cities before and after Craigslist introduced its erotic services section. And they found an average decrease of 17.4% in female homicide. Like, not just sex work, but homicide against women. Can we say for sure that those two things are, like, absolutely completely correlated? Maybe not, but it's a very interesting pattern that they've noticed. But it's not just consensual sex workers who are hurt by VostaSessa. Like, the people that it was put in place to help are also hurt by its existence.
In what way?
Okay, well, sites like Backpage and Craigslist were popular, and they were the logical places to go if you were trying to find or solicit sex. Which meant, like, if you were like trying to traffic somebody or find somebody underage for sex, these would be the places that you would go to. And I know that sounds bad to say, but it's like they were concentrated like markets, right? And it basically meant it was like easier for people to find people who were victims of this situation in one place and do something about it.
Right. So the obscuring kind of works in two ways. Like, it's also obscuring what they're trying to find.
Well, exactly. If they're trying to eradicate child sex trafficking, they're basically driving it into like darker corners. They're making it harder to find. And like in the lawsuits of parents suing Backpage for, you know, having ads of their underage daughters on there, they found their daughters posted on Backpage, which is like, at least you were able to find them in one place. The US government also admitted this in 2021 in a report saying basically that the FBI was having a harder time tracking down human traffickers post Backpage.
Wow.
So, but like one thing we have sort of established and do agree with like the anti-Backpage crusaders about is that these guys are shitty guys, Lacey and Larkin. And I believe the accusations people made against them, like making conscious decisions to sort of hide the existence of underage people on their sites. But I'm curious, like, do you think that if these guys were more exemplary characters and were playing ball with these organizations, that things might turn out differently? Do you think that FOSTA SESTA might not have happened?
I think that they were particularly maybe not loud, but kind of made themselves known in a way that garnered the attention of these kinds of people. And if they were kind of like personalities as well, it made them easier to hate, easier to like rally against. So maybe in a way. But I don't know, again, because everyone rallies so hard behind these causes, I think it would have been an inevitable thing. I just think maybe they like sped it up a little bit.
Yeah, I think like that's fair. They definitely made a lot of enemies. Like they were longtime enemies with John McCain and his wife because they're all based in Arizona.
I mean, fair.
Yes, yes, basically. But those two, his wife is heavily involved in the anti-trafficking organization. And those two were like on their asses throughout all of this. So they did make enemies. But I also think that like inevitably these people would have tried to find a way to outlaw or to amend Section 230. Either way, because before they deleted their adult services section, Craigslist like was trying to work with the FBI and law enforcement to stop trafficking. Like they were actually, at least from their report, communicating with them, like making efforts to report it when like people were posted on there that were clearly underage.
I think they could have saved themselves a little bit.
Yes. It feels a little bit like if Craigslist had the gusto of these guys, but maybe the morals of themselves, like maybe they could have like had a website that was appeasing both sides. But I also don't think that this side will ever feel satisfied unless they feel like they've eradicated trafficking.
Well, because it's not like these people who are rallying against child sex trafficking love sex workers and are concerned that they're gonna ruin sex work. Like they also hate sex workers. And they don't think, like, a lot of these people are extremely religious, extremely Christian, and they don't believe in sex work. And so either way, I don't think they would give a singular fuck if sex workers were harmed in the process because they don't believe in it.
No, exactly. I watched this like horrible documentary called I Am Jane Doe that I actually for some reason saw when it came out, and then I rewatched it, and it's the story of the like legal fights against Backpage told through the perspective of the plaintiffs who are suing them and their families. And their stories are very sad and like very like emotionally hitting. But the overall documentary is extremely one-sided, extremely biased.
Conservative.
There's not really any perspective from actual sex workers. And it's narrated by Jessica Chastain, which is random.
Is it? Like, is she famously...
I don't know. It's just know. Like, it's just a random documentary.
It is funny for an A-lister to be doing that.
Yeah. It was like this very impassioned thing against child sex trafficking, but they don't once mention actual sex workers and basically are using like these terrible anecdotes from these families that are very horrifying to justify the existence of legislation that like hurts so many more people.
It's like in trying to reduce the harm against children, they're doubling the harm against sex workers who are already more at risk than the general population of children are,
and,
statistically.
Yeah, and by like making these very like victim-led crusades, it just becomes very much about retribution against Backpage than it is about like actually solving the systemic issues that they...
Well, yes, and another great You're Wrong About episode is the victims' rights movement.
Well, yes, exactly. And in the documentary, they're basically like, it could be a good suburban child from a good family like ours, and they're so unconcerned with any of the actual systemic issues that put people in these positions.
Totally. It's giving that common talking point of whenever a woman is raped, people being like, that could be your daughter and that could be your sister or your mother. And it's like, what does that have to do with anything?
Yeah.
What does that have to do with anything? Like, it's just a very emotional appeal that lacks context and nuance.
No, exactly. And I feel very dubious about like having emotions so present in the courtroom.
The most frustrating thing about children's rights movements like this and anti-sex trafficking, anti-child trafficking movements, any movement that's in the name of children, the very thing that is frustrating about them is how apolitical they are, like is how bipartisan they are, because they just completely neutralize any background and any political background. And it is a political issue, you know?
Yeah.
Everything's political. And the foundations that have created a world where children are child sex trafficked are political.
Yeah.
You know?
No, exactly. It's like there are pretty well-known reasons that people usually end up in these situations, and really just like appealing to families that are scared that their suburban, like middle-class daughter is going to end up being sex trafficked. You're creating a bit of a boogeyman. Like, it doesn't, I'm not saying it never happens, but
the impact of Taken on the Western psyche has been an almost entirely negative one.
I mean, yes.
I will find you and I will kill you. I haven't seen it.
Me neither. Me neither. But curse you.
Taken 3 did give us that hilarious sequence.
Why does this girl keep getting taken?
I don't. Yeah. What's Taken 3 about?
He sounds like a bad dad.
He sounds like a bad dad. And I'm like, what's up with that?
Yeah. That's okay. Like, literally deal with your shit.
It's kind of giving Home Alone 2, 3, and 4. Like, why are you home alone again?
Yeah, it's like, maybe call child services.
Well, in the same way that Home Alone is also a suburban fantasy about defending your home.
Oh yeah,
defending your material possessions. Like, it's they're oddly similar. It's about suburban hysteria.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's just like, why do men love these narratives where they're basically like, get to come up with boogeymans, I don't know, justify...
Boogeymans. Yeah, I watched this Paul Schrader film that has kind of slipped through the cracks called Hardcore. I was really interested to see it because I was like, oh, Paul Schrader talking about the porn industry and it's the 70s, like, what's up? And the film is just... I like it because I think it's hilarious. It's just so funny. But the film is this kind of vigilante fantasy of a father going and saving his daughter from this dark underbelly of porn and snuff films. And then at the end she's like, dad, you're a terrible father and that's why I ran away and I actually love this industry. And he's like, I'll take you home, dear. But it was kind of fascinating.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
It's not a good movie. It was kind of the genesis of Americans discovering this seedy underworld and putting it in conversation with the suburbs.
Well, because this is around the time of... No, this is post-suburban sprawl, is it?
Mid.
Yeah.
Mid-suburban sprawl.
True. On an ethical level, because we know that they're obviously, like I said, you know, watching those girls in the film and like the victims who've created lawsuits against these guys, like there are people who have been impacted by it. But how do we kind of reckon with defending a multi-million dollar website and like internet company in the face of that?
I mean, in the same way that the end justifies the means with these guys accidentally doing good things, but also being shitty in the process of doing the good thing at the end, I feel like this is similar. Like, it's not like we're sitting down and defending the glory of Backpage. We're defending the people who were on it, the sex workers. And if we're going to be separating those two, as the Communications Decency Act does, we're defending the sex workers. I'm not like, oh, poor Backpage.
No, you know? Exactly.
But unfortunately, within defending the sex workers, you have to defend Backpage because that was their bread and butter. That's the platform.
Well,
it's their home. If YouTube got taken down, do I like YouTube? No, but if it got taken down, that would suck for me. So I would defend its honor.
I agree. And like, I think what they've also done in enacting FOSTA SESTA is basically make it impossible for a better alternative to Backpage to ever exist. And you want to know something ironic? In the end, FOSTA SESTA wasn't even necessary to bring down Lacey and Larkin because they were arrested in 2018 on counts related to the Travel Act.
What?
And so... Like, this was days or, like, very shortly before FOSTA SESTA was enacted.
Those freaking knuckleheads. Sometimes I feel like they're two guys who I want to kind of bang their heads together, you know?
Well, yeah.
Lacey, Larkin, but or else make them kiss. Are they brothers?
No.
Okay, make them
kiss. Have different last names.
Are they brothers? Hey, sometimes siblings can have different last
That's
names.
That's so true.
This is blended family erasure.
It absolutely is, and I'm so sorry. I've just unveiled one of my prejudices. It's blended families.
It's blended families.
I really believe in the nuclear unit and keeping it together.
Foster Sesta activists would love you.
Yeah. Well, too bad. Falsa Sesta is enacted into law in 2018. Lacey and Larkin are brought to court for other reasons, and it's kind of like a drawn-out process. There was a mistrial, and they keep getting new trials. And then last July, Jim Larkin ends up committing suicide.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. And then months later, Michael Lacey is found guilty of money laundering, but the jury deadlock on, like, 84 of his other counts.
Oh, man. 84. Yeah. What was the what was their violation of the Travel Act?
Basically, like, they were traveling between state lines to facilitate prostitution. Like, I think somehow, like, having Backpage involved with, like...
Oh, so they were trafficking?
No, they weren't trafficking. I think it's, like, traveling, like, for Backpage or something. Like, there were things...
It was, like, kind of a loophole where they're like, we'll get him on this, not
and
this.
Like, yeah, and, like, money-related stuff, too. Oh. So, yeah.
That's depressing on all fronts.
It's depressing, and it's kind of like, okay, so all of this was... A lot of this was happening in order to stop these guys, but it wasn't even necessary in the first place, and so many more people are hurt.
It's also like, aftermath. I'm sorry, you're pointing the attention at these guys and not the men doing child sex trafficking. Obviously, I think that there is some culpability, of course, but I think, like, who is the real villain here? Probably the guys doing the thing.
Well, exactly. In that documentary I watched kept describing Backpage as being a website that sells children. These guys are making millions of dollars selling children. And it's like, the way you're framing it language-wise is inaccurate, and
well,
it's making-
and it completely confuses what the Communications Decency Act was trying to do, which is separate the two things.
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously, it's more complicated than them being completely separate, as we said, but it doesn't mean, yeah, that these men are directly involved in this. I mean, I think with them getting involved in the language, the coded language, is an involvement. It's just hard because they are profiting off of it, and they probably did want it to keep going because they were like, well, we're making... I don't think they care about children.
Yes, I agree. I just think that framing it as a business that sells children as if that is, like, part of their business plan is inaccurate.
Yeah, it abstracts what is actually going on.
And again, like, then you'd be thinking about any of these types of websites that way, even ones that aren't as morally dubious as Backpage.
And again, it's this emotionally charged argument that completely depoliticizes what's actually happening.
Exactly. When Falsa Sesta passes, websites and internet companies swiftly begin modifying their community standards. Sex workers report having difficulty using PayPal for electronic payments. Sites like Reddit begin deleting pages dedicated to sex workers. And Craigslist gets rid of its personal section entirely.
Okay, some people need love. Like, some of us are just looking for love.
I know. It's like, I feel like that is a big loss for the world. And although it's not directly a result of Falsa Sesta, but, like, certainly related to it, major credit card companies also cut ties with sites like Pornhub, which, while, like, having their own shady past with content moderation, are relied upon by adult performers to host their videos and to make money. And then the Apple App Store gets extremely strict about the apps it hosts, and they end up temporarily deleting Tumblr, which we will be talking about in next week's episode.
Yes. Trying to get an image from Tumblr. I tried to get, like, a screenshot of some Tumblr images for my video this month. I couldn't. I had to use Pinterest instead.
Wait, what?
I can't get into Tumblr. I can't get in. It won't let me inside.
They won't let you inside.
They won't let me inside.
What do you mean?
They don't want to see a hot girl winning.
They absolutely don't. Wait, what do you mean?
Tumblr's really hard to access as a website now.
Really?
Yeah, well, we'll get into it.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of this, and this is something that I was thinking about at the beginning of the episode as well, I just keep coming back to this question of how do you protect children on these sites while simultaneously not making it so that adults can't talk freely about human behavior. Like, this has severely impacted my job. When I started on YouTube in 2018, the restrictions were so much looser. Have they put in writing why it's more strict? No. Their bots are just becoming insanely puritanical. And so, and this is especially for smaller YouTubers. Like, I'm not saying I'm a medium-sized YouTuber, but like huge YouTubers, I'll see swearing, they're talking about sex, they're talking about dicks, they're talking about whatever. And corporations will do this too that have YouTube channels. But independent creators who are kind of like medium to smaller creators get censored into oblivion. Like, the amount of videos I've had that seem to be taking off and then have limited ad runs because I've said the word sex, for example, is insane. I tried to talk about American Beauty in a video, didn't say a single thing directly about the relationship between Kevin Spacey's character and Mina Suvari's character, and I still got a limited ad run just because I had mentioned the name American Beauty. And it's just like, the harm is, it's huge. It's and it's like impacting adults, and there's a YouTube Kids for kids to go on, yet still this adult platform. It's not an adult platform, but it's a platform for people who are of age.
It should just be like a neutral platform, which means like it's not specific to kids, but it reflects our world. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think in the case of, not the case of child sex trafficking, but the case of children stumbling upon sexual content, I'm sorry, the onus should be on the parents. Why is your kid on this app? Like, that's your problem, not anyone else's. Mm-hmm. And same with Instagram. One of my photos just got taken down because there was like the faintest outline of a nipple through someone's shirt, and it got removed from the platform. How? Like, it's just so frustrating. I don't know. So I think in many ways it harms women. Like, women can't post their own bodies on Instagram without being censored.
Yeah.
And in a desexualized way too. So I think it's had a huge impact.
Well, absolutely. I think that like people will get really amped up and like motivated around like an issue like child sex trafficking. But like by getting people really focused on this, you're also kind of able to sneak in like a generally anti-sex agenda.
Yeah, conservative agenda.
Yeah, you're kind of creating a bit of a moral panic around it through this. Child sex trafficking is terrible and it is worth getting upset about, but then it's like, I think the actual objectives of the people who are like making it their cause run deeper than that.
Yeah, and a lot of the time the people who rally in the name of children don't give a singular fuck about children. Like, it's the same argument about, you know, people being pro-life, but then not caring about children in foster homes. Like, they don't care about actually making the world a better place for children. They want to focus on these really extreme examples where children are harmed. Sorry, I'm not saying that pro-lifers are in that category, but they're focusing on these extreme examples without actually looking at the systemic causes behind them or what else is harming children. And they don't want to hear what children have to say. They're not going to center their voices.
Well, no, because they would rather like live in this world where there's just like big, scary people waiting to like prey on nice suburban kids and like not really think about their roles as politicians a lot of the time in contributing to the kinds of environments where kids might be more susceptible to something like this.
Yeah, and truly I don't really have a solution. Like, I don't know how you go about it where you're not censoring absolutely everybody in the name of children. I think it's difficult, but I wish that they would stop Free the Nipple.
We will be talking more about that next week.
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.